Welcome back to the deep dive. Sometimes you get these fragments of information, bulletins, notes, headlines that are so cryptic, they look like they were pulled from seven totally different conversations. And today we're wrestling with exactly that. It's a snapshot of the outdoor world titled just simply Wild Week in Hunting 416.
It's a remarkable stack of sources, really. I mean, you have seven distinct nuggets of information that seem completely unrelated.
Totally.
Everything from, deep biology to logistics to, to pure unsettling true crime.
Right. So our mission here is to try and synthesize these pieces, to get past the weird headline and really understand the issues, the realities, and the human elements that are defining this world.
Yeah, for hunters, outfitters, landowners, all of them.
It feels less like a news report and more like some kind of bizarre Rorschach test for the whole community. Mm-hmm. But before we jump into the fish eggs and bow hunts, we have to talk about the context.
Oh, absolutely.
Because this source is really unusual. The material itself is bracketed by some extremely pointed advertising. We're talking about calls to action for things like hunting lease insurance.
Right. And guides and outfitters insurance.
And even vacant land insurance.
And what's fascinating about that is just the sheer professionalism and the specificity of that financial frame. This isn't just a random ad placement.
No.
It frames the entire bulletin as a communication from an organization that sees the outdoors through a very specific lens, the lens of risk management.
So we shouldn't just dismiss this as, a newsletter with some ads on the side.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
It suggests the scope of their concern is comprehensive.
Okay.
I mean, think about it. If you're in the business of mitigating risk for leased land or for guided trips, you have to care about everything that could possibly impact your client's operations.
So a crime on the property, that's a liability issue.
A huge liability issue. An ammunition shortage that prevents a hunt. That's a business interruption risk. Even these weird facts about wildlife diets, they affect conservation law, land management. They're giving you the whole 360-degree view of potential exposure.
Wow, that really reframes the whole mission. Huh. Okay, let's unpack this bulletin then. Let's start with the natural world, the three aha moments that kind of challenge what we thought we knew.
Sounds good.
We'll start with a classic outdoor mystery. Nugget number one is just titled, "He Found What in the River?"
Right.
The source says an angler made a discovery so shocking it stopped their trip. And they specifically exclude the obvious. They say, and no, it's not just a garbage pile floating.
And that exclusion is the key. It really is. I mean, any experienced angler is used to finding mattresses, tires, general junk.
Sure. It's part of the job, unfortunately.
It is. So for them to specifically state it wasn't a garbage pile, that suggests the object was either, inherently rare, maybe deeply illegal, or just symbolic of a much bigger problem.
So what kind of object then, besides an illegal dump site, would be that shocking to someone who literally stares at water all day?
Well, it forces you into speculation that goes way past the mundane, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You can imagine maybe three possibilities. First, it could be evidence of a huge environmental event, a major chemical spill, or maybe a protected species, like a huge sturgeon dead or distressed.
Okay, I see.
Second, maybe something archaeological, a relic or a rock formation that proves the riverbed is changing in a big way. But I think the most jarring thing for an angler,
what's that?
Would be a violation of the natural order. Finding an invasive exotic species, a fish or a reptile that has absolutely no business being in that river, that proves a devastating new reality for the ecosystem. That would get everyone's attention.
That makes so much more sense than just, shock value. It's about the implications for the habitat itself.
Exactly.
And speaking of biological puzzles, let's tackle the one with the best name here. Phil Eggs and Duck Butts, an old myth redefined.
I love this one.
They even admitted they thought it was a joke.
And this is where nature just kind of reminds us that we really don't know everything, not even about the oldest, simplest processes. What this is talking about is the concept of passive dispersal.
Okay.
Specifically, how viable fish eggs get transported between isolated bodies of water.
Right. We've all heard that joke, If a pond suddenly has fish, maybe a duck had an unfortunate bathroom situation flying over it.
That's it. Exactly. The source is referencing that longstanding debate over whether eggs can actually pass through a duck's digestive system and still be viable.
So the duck butts part is literal.
It is. It refers to the sticky, nutrient-rich mucus and feces near the cloaca. Or, eggs could just stick to the bird's feet and feathers after they wade through spawning beds.
And the redefined part of the title? That suggests they've confirmed it?
It implies that recent research maybe using genetic markers or lab simulations, has moved this from folklore to, well, scientific fact. And that is huge for ecological management.
How so?
It means we have to radically reevaluate how bodies of water become populated. If passive dispersal by waterfowl is a real, confirmed mechanism, it complicates everything.
Like managing invasive species.
Exactly. Because those ducks don't care about our regulatory boundaries. And it also affects conservation and stocking programs. It shows that nature has its own system of connectivity, one that completely bypasses our man-made irrigation ditches or stream structures.
So those clean lines we draw on a map, you know, defining one watershed from another,
right,
they're just constantly being blurred by a duck's commute.
A duck's commute, precisely. It just shows the incredible resilience and, frankly, the sheer ingenuity of life to find a way to migrate.
Incredible. Okay, now let's pivot to something that's equally disruptive to our neat little classification systems. Nugget number 3 asks, if you've ever had to wonder if Bambi was a vegetarian, I guess this answers that question.
And that implied answer is a very, very strong no. This one targets a core popular misconception that herbivores, you know, especially deer and elk, are strictly blank eaters.
Right. I think most of us picture a deer just nibbling on leaves and grass. What are we actually talking about here? Are they suddenly out there stalking rabbits?
Not stalking, no. But definitely consuming animal matter when they're driven by physiological necessity. It's known as opportunistic omnivory.
Opportunistic.
Yeah. And the core reason is usually a deficiency in their main diet. They're lacking essential minerals like calcium, phosphorus, or maybe high quality protein, especially in late winter or when they're pregnant.
So it's a survival strategy. It's driven by scarcity.
Absolutely. They will scavenge small dead animals, sometimes even eat nestling birds if they just happen upon them. Or, most famously, they'll chew on shed antlers or even bone fragments they find.
Wow.
And it isn't because they suddenly crave meat. It's just nature's logistics telling them, hey, you need to supplement your diet to survive and reproduce.
Yeah.
It reinforces that whole concept that survival transcends our neat labels of herbivore or carnivore.
That's a really powerful link, actually. Nature's diet is dictated by scarcity. And let's shift our focus now from nature's supply chain to the human one, because the hunt itself is all about logistics and resources.
That's a perfect transition.
So let's look at the active pursuit first. Nugget number 5 generates this huge excitement about the Montana elk hunt.
Mm.
The source writer is just so pumped, saying, an elk bow hunt, sign me up, N now W.
And Montana is, I mean, it's a crown jewel for big game hunting, especially for elk. But the specific excitement over a bow hunt points to a pretty sophisticated understanding within that community.
How so?
We all know bow hunting requires superior skills. You have to get much closer, have perfect shot placement. It's a whole different level of challenge.
So why that sign me up now energy? Is it about a specific rule change or a good tag draw or something?
It speaks to the perceived quality and the difficulty, you know.
Yeah.
Elk bow seasons often happen during the rut. So the action is dramatic. The stakes are super high.
Uh-huh.
The enthusiasm suggests the source believes this year, or maybe this specific area, is offering an exceptional opportunity. Maybe a successful draw rate, better herd size, or a chance at a true trophy bull. It's that ultimate combo of tough logistics and high reward. The perfect motivator.
But all that skill and all that excitement can hit a brick wall called reality.
Oh, yeah.
Which brings us right to nugget number 6, ammo. This is the most pressing logistical problem mentioned here.
Yeah, this is more than just a pain point. It's been an ongoing crisis for the entire shooting sports community. The source even says they've been dealing with this for months now and things aren't really looking up yet.
And the scarcity is universal. The writer hints at providing tips to help people find what we've all been looking for. For those of us outside the community, what specific logistics are failing? It's not just the complete rounds of ammo, is it?
That is such a critical distinction. While, yes, finished ammunition is scarce, the real bottleneck is deeper in the supply chain. It's often at the component level.
Like what?
The biggest constraint has been primers. Primers are the tiny explosive caps that initiate the cartridge. They are incredibly complex to manufacture, and only a handful of facilities in the world produce them.
So when demand spikes or a factory has a problem,
the entire supply chain just freezes.
So even the really dedicated reloaders who have gunpowder and casings, they can't build their own rounds.
Exactly. And specific hunting calibers get hit the hardest. You know, think about popular mid to long range calibers like 6.5 Creedmoor or certain Magnum rounds. If you rely on one of those for a big hunt and you can't get a reliable supply, your whole plan is just derailed.
So the tips are probably not just look online.
No, no. The tips are likely these highly specialized, community-driven strategies. Checking small, regional gun shops instead of the big box stores, trading components at local clubs, maybe focusing on less popular calibers. It turned preparing for a hunt into this complex scavenger hunt.
A lot like the deer looking for calcium.
It is. It's the logistics of scarcity, mirrored in both worlds.
Okay, so assuming you navigate that scarcity and you get the ammo, you still need the right gear. Number 7 shifts to that consumer focus with a seasonal hook. Christmas isn't that far, is it?
A classic but very effective marketing play. They highlight the newest and best hunting jackets 2021 and even link out to a review site.
Why focus so specifically on the jacket, though?
Because gear is mission critical, especially for big game hunting in cold places like Montana. A high-quality hunting jacket isn't just insulation, it's a piece of technology.
Right.
It manages moisture, it provides the right camouflage or, you know, the blaze orange for safety, and it offers essential protection from hypothermia. By framing it as early holiday shopping, they're encouraging preparation.
You don't want to find out your waterproofing has failed the day before a big trip.
You absolutely do not. Serious hunters test their critical gear well ahead of the season.
Okay, so we've covered the biology of nature's surprises, the logistics of the hunt, and the critical role of gear. But there is one item left that completely changes the tenor of this entire bulletin. We have to move from the mundane practicalities of buying a jacket to the profound disturbance of the unexpected human element.
That's a huge shift.
This is that sharp, jarring transition that shows why this source has to cover such a broad range of risks. We move to number 4. CMI. Criminal Mushroom Investigation.
The acronym itself tells the whole story. CMI. You have this quiet pursuit of foraging. A low impact, peaceful activity colliding with the most serious criminal reality you can imagine.
And the location is so precise and shocking. Body found in Peoria by man mushroom hunting. The writer even stresses that defiantly not this guy loved stumbling across the unexpected.
That shock is just, it's so profound because mushroom hunting or foraging, it's something people do to escape.
Right. It's a solitary thing.
Exactly. It requires quiet focus, patience, a connection to the environment. People go into the woods for peace, to find this natural bounty, and to have that experience completely annihilated by discovering a body.
Yeah.
It links their peaceful retreat to a homicide investigation. It's utterly destabilizing.
And beyond the immediate trauma for the person who found the body, what does this mean for the community this bulletin is serving? The landowners, the leaseholders.
It's a direct, serious liability issue. And that's why the insurance companies care so much. If that body was found on vacant land or a hunting lease or a property used by an outfitter, the police investigation, the cleanup, the legal mess, it becomes a massive risk. Landowners might find their properties a crime scene for weeks, maybe months.
Disrupting leases, costing money.
Significant money. It shatters that idea that solitude protects you legally. The peaceful act of using the land becomes subject to the chaos of urban problems that were supposed to be miles away.
It's a powerful illustration that the woods aren't a separate sanctuary. They're just another jurisdiction.
Exactly. And the simple practical lesson is that land use, whether for profit or pleasure, has to account for unexpected human intrusion, for crime, for liability. The fact that the source puts the CMI right next to ammo shortages and elk hunts shows they're all considered valid. Just vastly different. Operational risks.
So when we synthesize this entire wild week, the deer eating meat for nutrients, the duck eggs floating across watersheds, the fierce logistical battle for primers, and the quiet horror of a body found in Peoria, what does this all mean for us, for you, the listener, trying to synthesize this?
It means that the world of the outdoor community is defined by extreme complexity and unpredictability. You have to manage the constraints of nature like finding calcium, while at the same time managing the constraints of civilization like finding ammunition.
And the peace you're looking for can be revoked in an instant.
Instantly, by the unresolved drama of human events.
It certainly proves that if you're involved in land management or guiding or even just owning a vacant lot, the scope of risk you face is, well, it's breathtakingly broad.
Indeed. We've moved from the scientific curiosity of passive dispersal all the way to the visceral shock of the criminal mushroom investigation. And when we look at that profound, unsettling juxtaposition, the image of someone peacefully foraging for dinner, only to find the ultimate evidence of human tragedy, we're left with a final provocative thought.
What's that?
How does the perceived tranquility of nature change when we realize that the human drama and unforeseen consequences of this civilized world often follow us deep into the woods, forever complicating the very solitude we seek.